seized the FBI as well as other federal law enforcement agencies. Calls and texts to Donald Trump's lawyers and aides went unreturned after the contents of the warrant became public on Friday, 12th of August. A spokesperson for the U.S. Justice Department declined to comment. The disclosure of the contents of the search warrant and the receipt came hours before the deadline for Donald Trump and his legal team, led by Evan Corcoran, to oppose a motion by the Justice Department to make public both documents, which are no longer under seal. The motion to unseal, announced by Attorney General Merrick Garland in prepared remarks at the Justice Department on Thursday, does not currently include the affidavit accompanying the warrant that would give greater detail on the probable cause that led to the approval of the Mar-a-Lago raid.
Hello everyone and welcome back to another episode of The Subcontinent.
The Subcontinent.
Hello everyone and welcome to another episode of The Subcontinent. As you know, on this program we will address the most important issues in the South Asian region that affect the governments, organizations, communities and most importantly, the people. And as always, we will dissect the issues and present you with different perspectives from experts and people. So stay tuned.
In this edition of The Subcontinent, we will discuss the economic crisis India is grappling with, marked by growing trade deficit, currency depreciation, soaring inflation, and fuel shocks. And we shall also take a look at the traditional Muharram commemorations in the Muslim-majority region of Kashmir, as well as the ban on Muharram 8 and 10 processions.
When the coronavirus pandemic struck the subcontinent in the early part of 2020, the Indian economy was already in a downward spiral, with the growth rate plummeting to an 11-year low of 3.1%. The 2 years of pandemic and a series of lockdowns pushed it further down. Today, the world's second most populous country finds itself in the throes of a deep economic crisis marked by a widening trade deficit, depreciation of the national currency, soaring inflation, and oil shocks.
The fiscal year 2022-2023 has revealed unprecedented turbulence in India's economic sector, fueled by both internal and external factors. The country's trade deficit expanded to a record $31.02 billion U.S. dollars in July, primarily due to a fall in merchandise exports and a surge in imports. It marks a threefold jump from the $10.63 billion U.S. dollars around the same time last year, according to the preliminary data released by India's Ministry of Commerce and Industry. For the first 4 months of the year, the deficit stood at $100 billion U.S. dollars, up from the $42 billion U.S. dollars in the same period last year. India's national currency rupee has also seen depreciation in its value against the U.S. dollar, recording a fall of more than 5% in the last year, fueled by global headwinds and concerns of a widening trade deficit. Finance Minister Nirmala Sitharaman attributed to external reasons, including the Russia-Ukraine war, rising crude oil prices, and exacerbation of global financial conditions. The oil price shock has led to rising inflation in all oil-importing countries, including India. According to analysts, oil price risk presents a huge threat to the Indian economy, as supply losses are not likely to result in significant volume risk.
A The surge in oil prices in the wake of the Russia-Ukraine war has substantially and unmistakably affected the world's third largest consumer of oil, India, which imports 85% of its oil needs. The country's current account deficit is projected to widen to 3.1% of GDP in the financial year 2023 from 1.2% in the current financial year, according to the global lending body, the International Monetary Fund, despite the surge in cheaper crude oil imports from Russia.
India's crude imports from Russia jumped significantly from almost nothing in January to 300,000 barrels a day in March, 700,000 barrels a day in April, to 1 million barrels a day in June, now accounting for nearly 17% of the country's total oil imports, up from less than 1% before Russia's military operation in Ukraine. Although soaring crude prices may not impact India like other countries, global oil price shocks have traditionally caused depreciation in the rupee and an increase in the country's import bill. The soaring global energy prices have had knock-on effects on the rupee, with the Indian currency recording a drop of more than 5% against the US dollar year to date. The turbulence in the global energy market and rising prices are particularly challenging for India, as it pays for oil in dollars. When the rupee depreciates, the country's oil purchases also become expensive. According to analysts at Nomura, for every US dollar hike in the oil price, India's import bill swells by $2.1 billion. The fall in the rupee in turn also fuels inflation and bloats account deficit. The annual inflation rate in India surged to 7.8% in April 2022, the highest figure in almost 8 years.
Now, to have more insight on this, we are joined by Mr. Akash Goglani, public policy researcher from New Delhi. Now, welcome to the program, Mr. Goglani. Despite the rebound from the coronavirus pandemic, the Indian economy is still tottering below the pre-COVID trajectory. How and which sectors did the 2 years of pandemic hit the hardest?
Thank you, Mehdi, for the questions, and thank you for inviting me on the show. As you can see, across the world during the pandemic, the most effective sectors were the contact-based sectors, where there was a lot of human contact. In India also, you can say, I could name five sectors. One was obviously hospitality sector, people were not traveling. The other was tourism. Tourism contributes 7% of GDP in India. That was one of the major sectors. India also relies on very high, let's say, internal migration. So because you had labor markets disrupted with lockdowns, so 21-day, 2-3 months of lockdown, a first wave, then another waves of lockdowns. So we had a very low productivity-led construction sector. So construction sector was affected heavily, and you could see lines of people going back to their rural hinterlands for agriculture work. Then there was this aviation sector. So because there was no travel, so all the flights were canceled. So that was really hard. And I think the last sector which was affected was, I can say, public transport. Because you have no work, most work from home was happening. So one of the sectors which really was affected because public transport, railways in India, let's say public utilities like metros. So like in the world, it's slowly emerging back since last 2 years. So people have some semblance. So hospitality is back to pre-pandemic level. Aviation is back. We do see a lot of construction happening. So infrastructure projects, dedicated, let's say, freight corridor in India, it's coming back.
Mr. Goglani, today the South Asian country is struggling with a widening trade deficit, dwindling currency, soaring inflation and other issues. So could you tell us what has gone wrong?
Many, across the world, because it was a 2 years of pandemic, so we had a lot of, let's say, supply side disruptions. So I see, let's say, the dwindling rupee, the trade deficits and all these things in two major categories. First is the international factor. So we had, let's say, 2 years of supply side shocks. You had, let's say, semiconductors and chips were not working. So automobile sector, which was also hit hardest. So that was one of the all electronics were hit hard. Second, we all know the unfortunate Russian-Ukraine conflict that has totally disrupted the, let's say, the energy oil prices and crude prices, and India imports 85% of its crude resources from the world. So that's one of the major factors which has done this. And also you can see because there was this liquidity trap, which let's say last financial conditions were worsening, we could see some sort of Fed in the US taking back and the liquidity, which excess liquidity, which was provided during the pandemic, the excess kind of stimulus was taken back. That created, because India relies heavily on FDI inflows. That would so we saw a lot, let's say, a periodic 2 to 3 years of FDI on FPI inflows going back. The outflows were happening, and let's say these were the international factors. These were the larger systematic factors which has affected countries around the world.
Mr. Gulani, India's finance minister Nirmala Sitharaman attributes the fall of the rupee to external factors like the Russia-Ukraine war, rising crude oil prices and worsening global financial conditions. So what's your take on this?
Mehdi, I do concur largely with Minister Sitharaman because we are very heavy, let's say, oil and gas dependent country. Our imports are 85%. We are dependent on crude prices and everything. So the actual trade deficit got worsened. So I have this one fact. So if you look at quarter two of 2021, or let's say the spending on oil was $25 billion. But if you see the quarter two of this year, it has gone up to $45 billion. So that kind of trade deficit is directly linked with this change in, let's say, the oil prices, which is almost like $100 right now. Another reason, which I also mentioned in my last intervention, was this: because a lot of let's say global financial recession at US, we might see, because India relies heavily on, let's say, the software exports. So if you look at the trade deficit, or let's say the full balance of payments basket in India, we have surplus in, let's say, invisibles. We export software, pharma, which helps us, and we also import this kind of oil and gold and other minerals and all from. So in that sense, because the market of oil has disrupted, this has changed our let's say balance of payments. And also because there's this global recession, as you see in US, we might see some sort of cuts in our exports as well. So in that way, I do concur that largely our trade deficit and, let's say, depreciation of rupee is due to external factors.
On that note, I would like to thank Mr. Gulani, public policy researcher from New Delhi, for being on the program. Now, let's see how people have reacted on social media.
Javier Shergill, a Congress Party spokesman and Supreme Court lawyer, questions the Modi government's economic policy at a time when India's trade deficit has jumped with increasing imports and decreasing exports, urging the government to act to revive business. A member of India's parliament, Jawahar Sirkar, points to India's dependence on China by noting that imports have reached almost $100 billion, while exports remain less than a quarter of it. Pargat Singh, a sportsperson turned politician, says galloping inflation and rising fuel prices are making life miserable for the ordinary people in India, sharing pictures of a protest against fuel prices.
You're listening to The Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to The Subcontinent every Monday here on IRIB English Radio.
For the Muslims in Kashmir, Muharram commemorations have always been central to their faith. People have offered blood, sweat and tears to keep the tradition of mourning for the martyrs of Karbala alive. from the first Islamic missionaries that came to Kashmir from Iran more than four centuries ago till today, the tradition of Azadari in the Himalayan region has tremendously evolved and gained popularity, playing a pivotal role in preserving the distinct identity of Kashmiri Shias.
According to historians, Azadari in Muharram was popularized in Kashmir by Sayyid Ali Hamadani, the Sufi luminary who came to Kashmir from Iran in the 14th century. A staunch lover of Ahlul Bayt, he is believed to have brought many symbols of heritage from Karbala. The popularity of Persian Noahs in Kashmir is largely attributed to him. Another important figure is Sayyid Shamsuddin Araghi, who also came from Iran. During his time, the practice of Muharram commemorations became widespread in Kashmir. Until then, people would do Azadari inside bungalows owned by Shia aristocrats. He built the first Husseiniyah in Srinagar that in later centuries emerged as a symbol of Shia resilience.
Imam Hussein's personality cannot be defined. We have tried for the last 1400 years to carry forward his teachings and his values. And with passing time, we have seen more and more people are joining the caravan of Hussein. Imam Hussein is an epitome of greatness. And his sacrifice for Islamic teachings and values teaches the way forward. The first step is unity among Muslims.
During the Chalk rule in the 16th century, Kashmiri elegies gained unprecedented prominence and Azadari expanded far and wide. However, after the fall of Shia Chalks, the dark period started for Kashmiri Shias during the rule of Mughals and Afghans, when Muharram gatherings went underground. Shias were attacked and looted more than a dozen times, and the historic Husseiniyah at Zadibal Srinagar was also razed to the ground many times. During the Dogra rule in the 19th century, the first Muharram procession was taken out during the daytime in Kashmir. In 1989, the procession was banned by the government, citing a law and order problem, even though the processions are totally peaceful.
The trials and tribulations continue for Shia Muslims in Indian-controlled Kashmir. For the past 32 years, traditional Muharram processions in Srinagar, the summer capital of the region, remain banned. Heavy restrictions are imposed every year on Muharram 8 and 10 in the city center amid large deployment of troops. Like every year, this year too, mourners defied the government crackdown to take out peaceful processions. And like every year, security personnel resorted to force to disperse the processions and manhandle the mourners.
This year, two Muharram processions in the summer capital of Kashmir were broken up by security forces using unwarranted force. Young mourners were brutally beaten and manhandled. The government ban on traditional Muharram 8 and 10 processions remains in place since 1989, when the armed rebellion against Indian rule in the contested Himalayan region gained momentum.
All our Indian people enjoy religious freedom, but when it comes to Kashmir, they adopt double standards. Peaceful mourners here are thrashed and arrested for raising Labaik Ya Hussein slogans.
Each year, curfew-like restrictions are imposed in parts of the city. Iron barricades and spools of concertina wires are put up at every entry point. However, mourners defy the crackdown each year and take out peaceful mourning processions in the city. Each time they are intercepted by large contingent of police and paramilitary forces who resort to baton charge and arrest the mourners.
The government is hurting the religious sentiments of people here. We condemn it in the strongest term. Kashmiri's people have made it very clear that they will not accept a ban on procession. Even if they are beaten and arrested, they will raise the flag of Imam Hussein.
Muslims in Kashmir have been demanding revocation of the draconian ban, which they see as a blatant breach of their religious freedom and denial of fundamental human rights. They point to double standards of the government, which provides patronage and support for the annual Amarnath Yatra of Hindus, but denies the same right to Kashmiri Shias. There has been a long-running legal battle against the ban led by Kashmiri-based Shia organizations, but nothing has come out of it.
Now, to talk on this, we are joined by Mr. Sayyid Isar Mehdi. He's a religious scholar at South Asian University in New Delhi. First of all, welcome to the program, Mr. Mehdi. Now, Kashmir has a rich socio-cultural history, and the tradition of Muharram commemorations date back many centuries. Can you briefly tell us how this tradition evolved in the region over the past years?
This is a very interesting question. Muharram is the month in which the beloved grandson of Prophet Muhammad, so peace be upon him, Imam Hussain al-Islam, was martyred, along with his family and friends, in the desert of Karbala, by the tyrant called Yazid. Every year, around this time, massive processions take place across the world and also in Kashmir to pay rich tribute to martyr of Karbala. But in Kashmir, what happens that both the communities, the majority community and also the minority community, they come together and commemorate these processions. In Kashmir, it started in 1527 when Sultan Muhammad Shah was a ruler. And during that time, Shia Muslims, along with the Sunni Muslims, used to commemorate these processions together. And there were two major processions that were taken out from Kashmir. One from Nimash Bal to Imam Bara Zadibal, and the other from Alamgiri Bazar to Kushal Sar. Both these processions were basically taken out by Shias and Sunnis together. And also in 1977, when Sheikh Abdullah was the chief minister, he was also, because of his request, there was a joint procession taken out by both the communities from Abi Guzar to Zadibal, which is basically in Imam Bara. But what happened in 90s, in late 90s, what happened, the wave of militancy took over Kashmir. And at that time, the governor of the JNK imposed ban on the procession as a sweeping measure to deal with the political unrest. But after that, nothing happened. The ban was not lifted. And it still remains in the state.
Mr. Mehdi, what elements of Muharram commemorations are unique to Kashmir? And also, can you tell us a bit about Kashmiri Marsiyas, which are integral to these commemorations?
Marsiyas are very unique in Kashmir, and they have served a purpose of basically safeguarding Shia identity in Kashmir. Shia identity and Marsiya are they are basically hand and glove. What they have done, what Marsiya has done basically, they have basically survived Shia identity. Marsiya is a unique feature to Kashmiri Shia identity, and because of the Marsiya, Karbala and the martyrdom of Imam Hussain has survived and has lived from generation to generation. Marsiya has basically four important parts. The first part is that's called Hamd. In Hamd, what you do, you praise Allah. Second part is basically Naat. What you do, you praise Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him. And then there's third part that's called Madah. In Madah, what you do, you praise Imam Ali al-Islam. You glorify him. And then there's last part where you should reveal the martyrdom of Imam Hussain. You show that how Imam Hussain Islam gave his blood to tell the world that to never follow the dictates of an oppressor. You basically reveal that how Imam Hussain Islam offered a peerless sacrifice in Karbala only to uphold human values, and eventually gave his head, not hand, to set an example for the world, that give away everything but never buckle before a tyrant.
Mr. Mehdi, in many parts of the Muslim majority region, we have seen Shias and Sunnis together taking part in Muharram processions and events. Now, could you say Azadari is a thread that binds the two communities together?
Obviously, if we look at the event of Karbala itself, you will see that this whole episode of Karbala, there are voices of unity. Karbala has that glue within it. Even in fact, in Kashmir, you will see, as I said earlier, that Kashmiris use it to take processions together. Both majority and minority community use it to perform, use it to, you know, basically take out these processions together. As I said, in 1527, when Sultan Muhammad Shah was the ruler, Shia Muslims, who are the minority, used to take the procession with the Sunni majority together. In fact, there were two processions, as I said, from Nemechbal to Imam Barazedipal, and the other from Alamgiri Bazar to Kushalsar. Both were taken by Shia and Sunni communities together.
Thank you, Mr. Mehti, for being on the program. He's a religious scholar at South Asian University in New Delhi. Now, let's see how people have reacted on social media.
Saqib Mughlu, a Kashmiri journalist, says while the world grapples with sectarianism and extremism, Kashmiris continue to set examples of Shia-Sunni brotherhood, sharing a picture of Sunnis providing beverages and food items to Shia mourners. Kargil-based political activist Sajjad Kargili, pointing to double standards on religious freedom, notes that while Muharram processions are allowed across India, in Kashmir they are banned by the government.
And that was our episode about the economic crisis facing India and the traditional Muharram commemorations in Kashmir. We shall meet again next week. So till then, take good care.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
In the limelight.
In the U.S., Republican Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene of Georgia wants to impeach Attorney General Merrick Garland over what she says is the political persecution of former President Donald Trump. The article you're about to hear has been written by Newsweek journalist Ida Sisko. The article has been published by Newsweek and is titled Marjorie Taylor Greene seeks to impeach Garland for persecuting Trump. In the U.S., Republican Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene of Georgia wants to impeach Attorney General Merrick Garland over what she says is the political persecution of former President Donald Trump. Marjorie Taylor Greene accused Merrick Garland of endangering, undermining, and compromising the justice system in a resolution calling for his impeachment on Friday, 12th of August. She claims Merrick Garland persecuted Donald Trump by approving of the FBI raid of the former president's Mar-a-Lago home. Greene and other Trump loyalists have been raging since federal agents executed a search warrant at Donald Trump's residence, Mar-a-Lago, earlier this week. The FBI seized multiple boxes of documents, including many that were marked classified and some that reportedly may have included nuclear secrets. What they've been doing to former President Donald Trump is political persecution, Marjorie Taylor Greene told reporters before entering the Capitol to file the impeachment resolution on Friday, 12th of August. Merrick Garland has abused his position of power as the Attorney General to politically persecute President Joe Biden's enemies. And the whole purpose of this is to prevent former President Donald Trump from ever being able to hold office. I'm introducing articles of impeachment on Merrick Garland, she added, because we cannot tolerate this in America, where our great institutions are wielded and abused in such a way to impeach people's political enemies. Marjorie Taylor Greene is not the only prominent conservative to call for Merrick Garland's impeachment over the raid. Republican Senators Rand Paul of Kentucky and Josh Hawley of Missouri both suggested impeaching Merrick Garland during Fox News appearances this week. There is little realistic chance of Merrick Garland actually being impeached and removed from office due to a two-thirds majority vote needed for conviction, an unlikely prospect even if Republicans were unanimous and in control of both chambers of Congress following next November's midterm elections. The legal claims made in Marjorie Taylor Greene's impeachment resolution are also questionable at best. While Greene argues that the FBI's raid was political, the agency executed a search warrant that was obtained through a legal and not a political process. The search warrant cited alleged violations of multiple laws against the concealment or taking of official government documents, as well as alleged violations of the Espionage Act. The first of two articles of impeachment that Marjorie Taylor Greene's resolution proposes claims that Garland's personal approval of the search warrant was a blatant attempt to persecute a political opponent. The second proposed article of impeachment claims that Merrick Garland demonstrated a pattern of conduct that is incompatible with his duties as a civil officer of the United States by persecuting Donald Trump over documents he legally declassified. Donald Trump has said that the classified documents removed from his home, Mar-a-Lago, this week were declassified just before he left office, although the former president has not provided any evidence or any proof to back up his statement. Regardless, the documents seized do not have to be classified for Donald Trump to potentially be in violation of multiple statutes cited in the search warrant. Classified documents are also not required to be in violation of the Espionage Act. Donald Trump has also suggested without evidence that the FBI may have planted documents at his home. In addition, Donald Trump has claimed that former President Barack Obama violated the Presidential Records Act by taking 33 million pages of classified documents from the White House after leaving office in 2017. However, the National Archives and Records Administration, NARA, told the New York Times on Friday that Barack Obama was never in personal possession of official documents after leaving the White House, whether the documents were classified or not. The National Archives and Records Administration, NARA, said in a statement, "It had assumed exclusive legal and physical custody of Barack Obama's presidential records when President Barack Obama left office in 2017, in accordance with the Presidential Records Act." NARA, or the National Archives and Records Administration, moved approximately 30 million pages of unclassified records to a NARA facility in the Chicago, Illinois area, where they are maintained exclusively by NARA. The statement continued, "Former President Barack Obama has no control over where and how NARA stores the presidential records of his administration." Claims that FBI agents who searched Donald Trump's Mar-a-Lago estate were looking for classified documents concerning nuclear weapons have heated up speculation about the Bureau's extraordinary investigation into the former president. A Washington Post story, which relied on unnamed sources, followed earlier statements published in Newsweek that agents were seeking national defense information, according to two senior government officials. Meanwhile, an exclusive report by Newsweek cited sources in the U.S. intelligence community that said the top-secret materials could contain documents dealing with intelligence sources and intelligence methods, including human sources on the American government payroll. After the FBI raided the former president's Florida residence on Monday, 8th of August, it has remained tight-lipped about its investigation.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
The U.S. Justice Department says FBI agents have found 11 sets of classified documents, with some marked as top secret, in Trump's Mar-a-Lago home in Florida while executing a search warrant this week. The warrant was publicly released following a federal judge's order. It states investigators had probable cause to believe Trump violated three federal crimes, including violating the Espionage Act, obstruction of justice, and criminal handling of the government records. Media reports say the FBI search of Trump's Mar-a-Lago home was for possible classified materials related to U.S. nuclear weapons. Trump, however, rejected that. He called it a hoax and claimed he had no stored classified information. The unprecedented raid on the residence of the former U.S. president provoked a backlash from leading Republicans who described the move as politically motivated. The Florida governor, Ron DeSantis, said the search of Trump's property was another escalation in the weaponization of federal agencies against the regime's political opponents. Also, Florida Senator Marco Rubio stated that Biden is using his power to persecute Trump. But the White House has denied the allegations, saying it was unaware of the search before it happened. Moreover, there have been growing threats in recent days against FBI agents and offices across the country. On Thursday, a man who tried to breach the FBI's Cincinnati office was shot and killed by police after he fled the scene. Law enforcement officials say the man may have been present at the January 6th riot. Right after news of the FBI search of Mar-a-Lago broke, there was a big spike in tweets referencing civil war. Analysts and reporters say this is alarmingly similar to the activities in the lead-up to the January 6th attack on the Capitol.
Well, I think it's true that there are people in the permanent national security wing of the U.S. government who don't want Trump to return to office. And whether or not those people are currently raiding Trump in Mar-a-Lago in order to try to get proof of crimes they could use to charge him and put him in a position where he legally can't run for office.
Shockwaves spread across America in response to the news that the FBI had searched the private Florida residence of Donald Trump. It prompted threats of retaliation from the former U.S. president and his allies. The surge in violent rhetoric drew concerns that it could lead to civil unrest and a social crisis. Department of Homeland Security officials have been warning for months that this type of warlike rhetoric, which came to fruition on January 6th and which continues to be fueled by reactions to ongoing investigations of Trump, is increasing the risk of more widespread political violence ahead of the midterm elections in November. This comes as recent polls have shown a rising acceptance of political violence among Americans. About 1 in 3 Americans say they believe violence against the government can at times be justified. According to another study by researchers at the University of California Davis Violence Prevention Research Program and the California Violence Research Center, released last month, more than half of Americans expect that a civil war will erupt in the U.S. sometime in the next few years.
I think it is a sign that the U.S. Polarization has gotten way out of hand and could be leading to a constitutional crisis and possible civil war or social breakdown kind of situation. We have seen this polarization growing for many years.
Meanwhile, as much as 40% of election and poll workers in the largest jurisdictions in the U.S. have so far said they won't be returning to their jobs out of their own fears. Other states are seeing drop-offs too. Nearly one in three local election workers said they felt unsafe because of their jobs. The alarming partisan divide within the U.S. political system ahead of the vital midterm elections in November had raised concerns over the possibility of internal conflict.
Tensions are still high between China and Taiwan. The flare-up comes days after the provocative visit by U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi to the island. Officials in Chinese Taipei have rejected the one-country, two-systems plan proposed by China for the self-ruled island. Taipei says that only the Taiwanese can decide the island's future. The reaction came after China published a white paper on Taiwan, which Beijing says shows the resolute determination of Beijing to peacefully resolve the unification issue. The paper lays out China's position on the self-ruled island. It says Beijing would never allow any attempt to separate Taiwan, but also would make every effort to achieve unification through peaceful means. Taiwan has accused Beijing of using House Speaker Nancy Pelosi's visit as, quote, an excuse to destroy the status quo. Pelosi visited the island on August 2nd, despite vehement protests from China.
What they want to do with Taiwan is fight, U.S. wants to fight China to the last Taiwanese. If not to the last Japanese, if not enough, then to the last Korean. Ultimately, the U.S. will not fight the wars. It will finance them. It will give weapons. It will antagonize us. It will antagonize both sides. And that's what they want to do. And it's actually a replica to the World War II.
Beijing reacted with an unprecedented burst of military around the island. The drills lasted for several days. Taiwan has also launched live fire drills in the wake of China's largest ever military exercises. The white paper issued by China this week was the third document of its kind over Taiwan. The previous editions were the Taiwan Question and Reunification of China, which was published in 1993, and the One China Principle and the Taiwan Question, which came out in 2000. China insists differences in the social systems in mainland and Taiwan are, quote, neither an obstacle to reunification nor a justification for secessionism. But Beijing says it will not rule out the military option to achieve such reunification.
What China wants to do with this white paper is just to find a way with Taiwan to get it back to its sense, because reunification will happen. The problem is that if it doesn't happen peacefully, it will happen by force. China doesn't want to do it by force, but it's being pushed on the corner by the U.S. because the U.S. is actually slowly declaring Taiwan independent.
Speaker Pelosi's controversial visit has undermined the One China policy, which is recognized by nearly all countries of the international community, including the United States. Under the policy, the international community recognizes Taiwan as part of China, and the U.S. is committed to recognizing and having formal ties with China rather than the island of Taiwan. But Washington, contrary to its stated policy, continues to undermine China's sovereignty and courts the secessionist government in Taipei.
So what is the one country, two system? It was applied actually the first time is in Hong Kong. And so since the handover in 1997, they applied the one country, two system. The way it was done in Hong Kong was that Hong Kong could keep its a very high degree of autonomy. And actually they did it for Hong Kong, and it was a way, a showcase that could they could show to Taiwan to say, well, in case you were to reunify with the mainland, this would be the system.
China has proposed the one country, two systems model to win Taiwan back. The policy allowed the Chinese government to successfully solve the question of Hong Kong through diplomatic negotiations with the British government. Hong Kong was under colonial British rule since the 19th century. China resumed to exercise its sovereignty over the island on July 1, 1997.
But what happened in Hong Kong was that you had the external forces. You had a massive amount of money being poured by NED, National Endowment for Democracy, and you had the usual suspect, the whole team of regime change working for the US, the MI6, and they did everything to destroy the one country, two system in Hong Kong, and that ended up with the riots. And then in 2020, you had the national security law.
Under the model, offshore regions like Hong Kong remain under China's sovereignty but can retain their own economic and administrative systems. Now China insists the same model could be applied to Taiwan.
Iran is making giant leaps in its peaceful space program. Iran has just launched its Khayyam satellite into orbit. The satellite was sent into space from the Moscow-operated Baikonur Cosmodrome in Kazakhstan. Khayyam satellite was sent into orbit on Tuesday by Soyuz 2.1B rocket. Iran says it will also use imagery from Khayyam to monitor Iran's borders and improve the country's capabilities in management and planning in the fields of agriculture, natural resources, environment, mining, and natural disasters. After all, Iran is surrounded by US bases, and terrorists have preyed on Iran to enter its soil to conduct terrorist operations. Contrary to claims made by Western media outlets, Tehran insists the Khayyam satellite is fully controlled by Iranian experts and technicians based inside Iran from the very beginning of its launch. However, not everyone is happy about this satellite launch. The US expressed anger at Iran's partnership with Russia and accused Iran that the aim of the satellite is spying, something Iran has categorically rejected. The US has said they suspected that the satellite could be used by Moscow to spy on troop movements in Ukraine. Yet, Iran is resolute in its cooperation with Russia. It has said it will continue production of such satellites with Russia, adding that it's a great honor for Iranian technicians to work alongside Russian technicians who have more than six decades of experience in the field.
Yes, well, the US government, of course, is particularly concerned about this. It really, in many respects, it should have seen this coming. It should have seen cooperation between states that it has under attack coming. But the arrogance, I think, of the US in particular, of Washington in particular, blinds it to these sorts of developments. They could ignore the fact, for example, that small states like Syria, like Cuba, were able to cooperate together. But when large states like Iran and Russia cooperate together, there's the inevitability. There's going to be new developments which free those countries, those peoples, from the domination of the US.
The launch of Khayyam satellite has been hailed as, quote, an important milestone in Russian-Iranian bilateral cooperation that paves the way for implementing new joint projects. It has ushered what Iran has dubbed as its strategic aerospace cooperation between Tehran and Moscow. Russia now says it's open to cooperation in the field of space exploration with all interested countries and partners, specifically Iran. The launch is also seen as a major achievement for Iran, despite Western sanctions.
Okay, so it's very important. The cooperation between Iran and Russia in satellite technology is very important because it shows a cooperation between large states with great capacity, which are both under economic blockade by Washington in particular. I would say Washington rather than the West, because really there are some mixed feelings in some parts of other Western countries. But certainly Washington is very jealous of any sort of independent achievement by Iran or Russia.
Iran says Western sanctions cannot stop its scientific progress. Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi has said that the successful launch of this satellite is a great achievement for Iran. This comes as Iran has made significant achievements in the field of science and technology in recent years. Earlier this year, Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps Aerospace Force launched its second homegrown satellite into a low Earth orbit nearly 2 years after the launch of its first military satellite. The IRGC successfully put Nur 2 or Light 2 into orbit on March the 8th. Iran has already mastered the technology to build remote sensing satellites with an image resolution of 5 to 10 meters and can inject up to 50 kilogram packages into an orbit of 500 kilometers. But Khayyam can hit a much more precise resolution of 1 meter. Iran aims to achieve the technology to put a 100 kilogram satellite into the 500 kilometer orbit by next year.
Ten years have passed since the start of war in Syria, but the country still seems to be in the midst of a conflict. So who's fighting who, and why does this seem like a war without end? For years, the Syrian war was the biggest news story, but now not so much. Cities and railways are being rebuilt, domestic flights have even started up again. Meanwhile, foreign forces have on the other hand ramped up their efforts to push their own agenda. The UNHCR even says the amount of investment to fuel the ongoing crisis compared to the money to alleviate the impact of the war on the Syrian people is very little. When the war started, Syrian government forces fought against US and foreign-backed terrorists. The US, its allies such as the UK and France, as well as Saudi Arabia and others, sided with the opposition and supported these terrorists. But Syria's legitimate government also had its own allies, namely Russia and Iran. Amid the ongoing chaos, terrorists took advantage of the crisis and soon became a common enemy to everyone. Now, over the course of the years of conflict, Daesh continues to operate in northern Syria with the help of the US to achieve its own goals at the cost of the Syrian people. The US has been accused of both hiring terrorists and training them to destabilize the country. This comes while a large portion of northeast Syria's crude oil resources have fallen onto the hands of the US. So does this confirm that the US is in one way or another fueling the conflict to continue its illegal occupation and abuse of Syrian resources?
The big question is what right does the US have to be in Syria at all? It has no right, and everyone wants the US out. Probably even Eastern Europe, the EU probably would like the US to be out. So the US is working with the other Syrian rebels, army defectors, rebel.
The Pentagon has confirmed that the Russian military conducted its second known strike in 2 months near a US base in Syria. Moscow says the airstrike was conducted against a group of US-backed militants in Syria near Al-Tanf. According to some reports, the US then warned the terrorists to move their positions. The US has used these terrorists interchangeably between Iraq and Syria to do its dirty work. It has also transported these terrorists to Afghanistan, with some reports indicating they were transported to Ukraine. The Russian strikes come at a sensitive time due to the Ukraine conflict and tensions between Moscow and Washington. The Pentagon is trying to ensure tensions don't escalate with Russian forces, including in Syria, where the two sides have operated in proximity to each other for several years. Both Russia and Syria have time and again stated that the US is training former Daesh members. Moscow has even specifically stated that Washington is trying to further destabilize the country. It also says that the Al-Tanf US base is illegal and that it and the area around it have become a void where terrorists operate unhindered. Since the Al-Tanf base formation, however, the United States has claimed that it's a temporary facility used to train partner forces to fight Daesh. It has rejected the Russian claims, saying Washington remains committed to killing Daesh and denying it safe havens.
And Russia warned the U.S. over 2 months ago in June. It said, we're going to be bombing So, you know, and they were actually telling the U.S., okay, we're going to bomb. So then the U.S. can phone up to the Mugawar al-Thawr, the commanders of the revolution, and say, you know, you're going to be bombed. So, I mean, I think that's stopped. I think the Russia's getting a bit more assertive now. And they're like the neo-fascists in Ukraine. And there the U.S. is supporting the same kind of rebel forces against Russia. So it's the same scenario transplanted into Syria.
The U.S. cut ties with Damascus over alleged rights violations by the Syrian government. But now, despite attempts by Syria, Russia, and Iran to rebuild the war-ravaged country, American troops continue their illegal occupation of parts of Syria, hindering any such attempts and further proving Washington's twisted logic.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
While Rudy Giuliani and John Eastman were key lawyers for former U.S. President Donald Trump and his campaign, respectively, and Jeffrey Clark was a senior Justice Department official, the trio played big roles in a brazen multi-front drive not to certify some of Joe Biden's electors, but bogus ones for Donald Trump. We have prepared for you an article written by Peter Stone. The piece is titled, Lawyers Feel Heat as Legal Net Tightens on Trump Plot to Overturn Election. Former prosecutors say an accelerating Justice Department investigation into a fake electoral scheme to help Donald Trump overturn the 2020 election, plus explosive testimony from January 6 hearings, have created intense legal heat for the lawyers Jeffrey Clark, Rudy Giuliani and John Eastman, who were key players in the abortive effort. While Rudy Giuliani and John Eastman were key lawyers for Donald Trump and his campaign, respectively, and Jeffrey Clark was a senior Justice Department official, the trio played big roles in a brazen multi-front drive not to certify some of Biden electors but bogus ones for Donald Trump. That could fuel charges against Trump, who they collaborated with for obstruction of an official proceeding of Congress or defrauding the United States. Legal experts say recent Justice Department actions, including seizing electronic devices of John Eastman and Jeffrey Clark, coupled with some evidence at committee hearings, are increasingly likely to spur charges against the three lawyers related to the drive to replace electors Biden won in seven states with fake electors for Donald Trump. The Justice Department's expanding criminal inquiry became palpable on 22nd of June when FBI agents raided Jeffrey Clark's home and separately seized John Eastman's cell phone as grand jury subpoenas involving the scheme were served up on top Republican figures and Trump allies in Georgia and Arizona. In another stark sign of the legal jeopardy Rudy Giuliani and John Eastman face, recent House committee hearings into the attack on the Capitol offered evidence that both lawyers sought pardons from Donald Trump, presumably tied to plotting strategies to block Biden's certification by Congress on 6th of January 2021, and fiery speeches they gave along with Trump at a rally on the Ellipse before a mob of Trump allies and supporters attacked the Capitol. The legal threats facing Jeffrey Clark were underscored at a 23rd of June panel hearing by scathing testimony from former top justice officials about Donald Trump's plotting with Jeffrey Clark to elevate him to acting attorney general to push the fake electoral scheme by falsely claiming in a proposed letter to Georgia officials